Hey, welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, where America learns to persuade because we need it. We need to figure out good talk over bad talk. And that's what we're about. Complicated times require sophisticated techniques. We're coming at you from the intersection of politics, rhetoric, and comedy. That's my street corner. I'm Dr. Dan French, PhD in rhetoric, escaped professor, stand-up comedian, and comedy writer from late night and Hollywood, that place. Here's a couple of jokes from the week. If you go to Twitter, my Twitter at Rhetoric War, I write jokes all day long. That's all I use social media for, really, is jokes. So Trump has actually come out and issued 74,223,744 pardons. So he's just going to take it all off the, take it right off the table, which I think is genius. And I'm waiting for the insurrection deniers, like the ones that are going to be like, the whole thing is digital, created by Hollywood. Nice try, libs. We got you. That's coming. This is the day we're recording. This is the day of the impeachment debate. We'll see what happens with that. On the podcast, I talk to comedians about their politics. I also talk to persuasion professionals to gather some of their secrets for magically taking you, helping you take people from where they are to where you want them to be. And I sometimes try to convert people from whatever their politics are. Typically, I pull people from the right. Not that I'm exactly a leftist or a lefty, but I think, you know, I think the right has this really strong politics right now, and it makes for an interesting set of people to talk to. So visit us at rhetoricwarriors.com, take one of our courses in persuasion, and just keep checking us out. My guest this week is a guy I'm really kind of fascinated by. I've known him for quite a while, and he's quite a character, has done some really cool stuff. Has a longtime brand, Livin' La Vida Low Carb. He lost a ton of weight, as I did at a certain point. He's been big in the alternative health communities. I knew him from the paleo community for a long time. He's morphed over into his own, I don't know, guru. I would call you a guru of sorts, you know. You can go hear his guru-ness at Jimmy Rants every Thursday. I think he does that. He has a new podcast out named Real Talk and quite a few books. Really interesting guy. Welcome to the podcast, Jimmy Moore.
My guru-ness is just shooting today. I literally don't like that term guru, by the way. Like whenever people say, oh, I'm a guru follower, you're my guru. I'm like, oh, hell no. Don't make me your
guru. It's guru'd.
What'd you say?
I said it's guru'd to call somebody guru.
So rude. By the way, I do Jimmy Rants Monday through Friday, not just on Thursdays. Real talk.
You have to admit that I was damn close with all that.
You were so close. And then you ignored the longest running health podcast on the internet, Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show, Tuesday, Wednesday. So
there you go. Well, see
it all up, Dan. Good job.
Everybody's got to do a podcast. Doesn't mean they're good at it.
Hey, I've done 15 podcasts.
15?
15 different ones.
You're running 15 podcasts right now.
No, I said I have done in my life 15 podcasts.
Wow.
Yeah, so a bunch of them are retired, but I currently have four. And I also do another one on Mondays. I forgot to tell you, we just started, called One Step Deeper, where we kind of dig deep into kind of the mindset, why you believe what you believe and think what you think. I do that with my best friend, Brittany. One Step Deeper podcast. So yeah, dude, I'm like busy. You know me. I've always been a go, go, go kind of guy.
Talk about that. Tell people a little of your background. I typically section my guests off into the areas that I'm interested in. And you've got five or six, but one is definitely this idea of, you know, your background of where you were, and you came into this space, which is available to everybody now through digital, you know, and through cheap production, to actually have a public produced voice. I mean, it used to be you have to go stand down at the street corner, you know, downtown, and yell at people, hand out a flyer or two to get a semi public voice. But now, you know, digital has made it available to everybody, and you are one of the guys that has just jumped right in there and taken full advantage of it.
And it's so easy. Like, I'm surprised by how many people are so timid. And I think they see someone like myself or some of the other ones out there that have made a name for ourselves. And they're just like, wow, they're like so polished. They're so good. I'm not that good. I'm like, guess what? Neither was I when I first started. Like, this is 15 years of consistency, always trying to be better, always trying to better myself. And you get better by doing. Like, people forget, like, you don't master something until you've spent, what, 10,000 hours on it? So I've easily mastered this by now, only because I've just done it. Repetition makes reputation is the old adage.
I like that one. I don't think I've heard that one. Repetition makes reputation, good or bad, I guess.
Right. Right.
So podcasting, you do live events, you write books. What do you, when you look at, if you were advising people, like this idea that you can carve out some space, and I see people, you know, all the time, I've done a ton of marketing work with people who want to be, you know, public figures, gurus, thought leaders, whatever you want to call them, that they need help, you know, they need marketing help. They need to establish some space. You can get on there pretty easily, but grabbing an audience is a whole different thing.
Yes. So the key I always tell people, and I consult people for free, I should start charging for this, but I'm going to give it to your audience today for free.
There's free stuff from Jimmy Moore.
So what I always tell people is, if you want to create a brand, if you want to become something known, go to something nobody's talking about. Like, when I first started talking about low-carb diets, Dr. Atkins had died the year before. There was a bunch of old white guys, researchers. They didn't know how to write nothing. So I come along with Living La Vida Low Carb blog in 2005 because I'm just a lay person who lost weight on this. And I'm like, okay, I'm still kind of learning. Let me just take that thirst for knowledge as the everyman and then throw out information based on my own experiences. And then as I start interviewing people, I get knowledge and then I disseminate that knowledge. And if it's nerdy knowledge, I explain that nerdy knowledge. And I just got good at it, to the point that now I have a bunch of best-selling books that have, you know, just impacted people's lives. But it didn't happen on day one. Day one was, ooh, nobody's serving the low-carb community. I'm going to be the guy. So find that niche that you are interested in. And oh yeah, by the way, super passionate about it.
Yeah, because you're going to be talking about it a lot. I mean, how many interviews have you done, Jimmy? How many people have you interviewed? It's got to be over 1,000.
Oh, dude, it's over 3,000.
3,000 people.
Yes.
And you're talking like, these aren't like simple interviews. These are experts, like people with deep expertise on very, you know, physiological, intricate, you know, areas.
And I was so intimidated at first by some of the researchers and the big time names that had written books and doctors. I'm over all that now, by the way. I consider them all colleagues. And I can stay there on a mental level. I may not understand all the ins and outs of all the medical processes if I'm talking to a medical doctor, but I can hang with them when it comes to like the metabolic pathways and insulin and inflammation and da-da-da. And I can kind of go there with them and even challenge them. In fact, the funnest thing that ever happened to me was when I was interviewing a researcher, no lie. And I said, interesting study you did there, but you should have done this, 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 and this. He's like, oh my God, that is brilliant. I'm going to do that. So, and then he did the study. I was like,
oh, that's great.
I'm a lay person. And I taught a researcher how to do a study.
Well, I think, you know, that's the thing. One of the cool things about the human brain is that you expose it to something over time, it absorbs it and starts using its powers on it. You know, you come at it from different perspectives and different experiences. I see this a lot in politics right now. And we'll maybe get into this, you know, in the podcast. Like I said, there's so many things I could talk to you about, but that when people get in and now and they're everybody's being exposed to politics, you know, and they're getting their brains saturated in politics. And there's so many shoots, you know, digital shoots coming into your brain from places that they don't really, it overwhelms them, you know, and then they internalize it and they start using it back as if they're experts. You know, I've got a friend, comedians do this a lot. They're very good absorbers and then reinterpret into humor. And, you know, he's very right wing and he absorbs a lot of stuff. And then he says it back to me and I'm like, man, you gotta, you know, there's, you've gone about 12% into the issue, you know, that other 88% is probably going to be useful for you to really understand this.
Yeah. I have no use for one sourced topics. If one website just happens to talk about something, oh, did you hear that blah, 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 blah. And I'm going, okay, corroborate it. Where's the other evidence that corroborates what that is? Because if I don't get some kind of totality of that subject, I ain't going to talk about it. I ain't going to share it because it's irresponsible. Any person that has taken journalism 101, always get multiple sources before you report on something. You don't have anonymous sources, even though that's become popular in media, and you don't have single sources for a story. You've got to have multiple sources that are credible sources. And usually it's patriotsfortrump.com. And it's like, okay, anything else? I mean, it's nice what they put, but they literally could have put anything on that website. Right. Show me some more evidence. And so that's kind of where we get into trouble. And if you've watched The Social Dilemma, which is right up your alley, that documentary on Netflix, did you see it?
I know what it is. I haven't watched it yet.
And it talks about how all of the social media sites literally tailor what you see, including YouTube, including Facebook, and all of them. And they basically put in your feed what they know you want to see and what they know will incite you to react. That's what keeps you around. And so
when you know, by the way, that documentary is designed to incite you to react, which I always think, like, you know, the triple levels of real rhetoric, like when you use rhetoric to go back and start laying back or unpeeling all the layers, and you're suddenly like, oh, I'm being manipulated about being manipulated.
Yes. Yeah. You know? Yeah. And fair enough. I agree with that, by the way. But it does make an interesting point to at least think about, okay, am what I hearing, is it fully filtered out? Is it fully vetted out so that I get what's actually happening? Or am I getting a version of what's happening? And I'm tired of seeing versions of happen. I want to know what happened. What happened to good old fashioned reporting the facts, just the facts, ma'am?
Yeah, it's an interesting time, Jimmy, like from the social media. I mean, it started with cable media and then moved over into social media. These have never existed in human history. You know, this type of distribution of knowledge or information, distribution of misinformation, it's never been accessible. Humans have no history with it, and they don't know how to do it. Like, we are not built to parse between that many sources. Like, it is literally overwhelming the human brain. And so the things you're talking about, like, you know, finding, you know, journalism, for example, multiple sources has always been one of the foundations of journalism. You know, finding credible evidence and all these things becomes incredibly difficult in this kind of environment, you know, and it just breaks people's brains. Logic is now breaking people's brains.
Well, and then when you throw in the monkey wrench of now you have gatekeepers who are allowing you to see certain information and not see other information. You also have certain people that are allowed to be on certain platforms and not being allowed on certain platforms. Like, it's a slippery slope at this point. It's the wild, wild west right now.
Yeah, they're all slippery slopes. Everything's like slippery slopes are slippery slopes, you know? So let's talk about that since it just happened. Like, I don't know where you are. Like, you know, I knew you again from the alternative health community, and that's its own politics. That's its own brand of crazy. Like, it's always fighting against the dominant paradigm, right? That's the Western med paradigm, the, you know, low carb versus high fat, you know, all these different paradigms are at war, vegan versus paleo. They're all at war within those communities. And it's intense. I mean, the politics in there and the, you know, the work that everybody has to do to try to sell their perspective, you know, not just with facts, but with this kind of allegiance.
Yeah.
You know, especially the vegan community, because it ties into so much about animal cruelty and sustainability and all that. It goes way beyond facts and moves you right over into, you know, this sense of ethical and moral obligation or sins and, you know, sinning against the planet. And, you know, that's where I know you from. So that world has tons of paranoia in it, you know, and tons of very highly competitive, rhetorics going on. So would you say that's like what, like you coming through there, like you were kind of a volatile figure at times in that community?
Volatile is a harsh word, but I guess in the world of rhetoric, it's probably apropos.
Controversial, like you were a controversial location. I remember listening, one of my favorite podcasts that you ever did was when you were talking to, what's his face?
John McDougal.
Yeah, John everybody McDougal. Loves that, right? Because it was pure conflict. Like it was such pure conflict right there. And he was just losing his shit on you. You know, and it was fun to watch. So that got into like reality style entertainment rhetoric. It wasn't, you know, fact-based. It was just two guys going at each other. And it was interesting to listen to.
Yeah. Episode 686 of the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show, literally my most infamous episode ever. And that was over a decade ago now. But yeah, I mean, it's fascinating how a lot of the news media out there today, it's not about reporting facts. It's not about reporting information. It's about making you react and have the entertainment value. It's why CNN blasts 24/7 how horrible Donald J. Trump is as a human being. Like literally, I've never seen them even say one thing nice about him. Even the biggest enemy I have, and I'm thinking of them right now, I could think of a few nice things to say about them. But the totality of what I think about them is not so nice, but nothing nice. So the rhetoric that you get from CNN is, wow, this Donald Trump is worse than Hitler. And it's like, and people actually say that. They say it out loud. And I remember I saw some conservative commentator in a YouTube video. He had Stalin and Khrushchev and all these ugly leaders. And then they put Donald Trump and they said, which one is the worst leader you've ever seen and has done the most atrocity? And they all are pointing to Donald Trump. Now, I know they can edit it. Maybe some people point to Stalin or Hitler, but
yeah, we need more ugly leaders. We don't have enough comparisons out there. Like you go right to Hitler and everybody's like, there's gotta be somebody in between Hitler and Trump, you know?
I mean, Stalin, I mean, you could go down the list.
Nobody knows anything about Stalin. Like you ask Americans, they barely know he's Russian.
Well, they need to know who Karl Marx was. Like, there's a lot of like.
Marx wasn't a repressive leader. He wasn't an ugly leader. He was just thought leader.
He was a thought leader that had some interesting ideas that are now heavily being debated today.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all he did was, you know, there's a bunch of guys, sociologists like that, sociology of money, who went, you know, you look at what's going on in capitalist cultures and non-capitalist cultures and you talk about it and you're going to be right in the middle of Marxism because he's just the first guy really just jumped in there and, you know, just wrote the hell out of it. So let's get into it a little bit then. So like I've heard, you know, some of this, I've seen a lot of this like in the alternative health community, there was a lot of libertarianness in that community.
Right.
You know, a lot of very independent thinkers, people didn't like the right or the left and they were trying to find some of their own space for it. Very highly individualism, you know, was rampant in there about taking responsibility for your own health and this anti-government, anti-media, anti-big, you know, corporate, all that kind of stuff. So is that where you're at now? Like politically, like describe yourself for me politically.
Well, let me piggyback on what you just said. The reason people have those feelings is you've been lied to. Like, and when you have your eyes open to just how much you've been lied to, like a little white lie, okay, no big deal. We get it. Everybody does that. But when they told some whoppers, like saturated fats,
for sure.
Block your arteries. Big whopper.
Yeah.
Big whopper. And then we hear about like the seedy underground like meetings that took place that said, well, we know saturated fat is benign, but we can't let sugar because we can make too much money off of sugar. And so we have to like squelch any research that shows sugar is bad and we need to make saturated fat look bad somehow, some way. Oh, it raises your cholesterol. It clogs your arteries. There we go. Heart disease. Everybody's going to die.
That's a nice, that is a very nice, you know, nicely organized corporate conspiracy, you know, truth. You know, there's some definite truth to that. It may get overblown, it may get underblown, I'm not sure, but there's definitely a truth that corporations and seats of power collude with, you know, persuaders and rhetoricians to sell their interests, you know.
So you've been lied to like that, it makes you skeptical skeptical of everything. Like right now, this big poke in the arm thing, I can't say it or you'll get banned. They'll censor you. But the little stick in the arm for this thing I call 9-1 Divock, just do it backwards. That's, you know. And so when you get the poke in the arm, like, think about that. Who's the company making that? Pfizer. What has Pfizer done over the years? Look up, guys. Just lots go things, look up.
Right? Lots Europe, of things. All those big Europe, corporations have done lots of things. And
yeah,
a lot
but
of
they're
easy, a lot of
they're
not.
The worst offenders. Go look up. There's a seedy background with Pfizer of all these things that they've had to pay damages on because of their drugs. And now they're scot-free on this new one. So it kind of feeds into why people are skeptical of this. I know you asked me what my political persuasion is. I'm getting there, but
yeah,
I just think
we're just, I like to wander, you know, and I'm just following what I find interesting. And like I said earlier in the intro, I think a lot of times to me, the fervor and the certainty of the right, especially the far right, really interests me. Like it's, I found it to be a really good energy. I think sometimes a content, I call it the, hot dog in the bun problem, that they slip the new hot dog in on people. Like it used to be like anti-communism or whatever. And so the bun and everything's the same, but now it's a new content in there. So like what you're saying about like distrusting, you know, big corporations, big pharma, you know, clearly there's reason, lots of reasons to distrust big pharma, you know, in America. You know, Michael Moore made a documentary about it. It's a very strong theme. And, you know, all the stuff that they've done recently about jacking up prices, like insulin going from $20 a month to $5,000, and, you know, just all this crazy, evil kind of corporate stuff. So there's good, clear villainy story materials in there, you know? And so when you start telling those stories, they're very reactive and they're very sticky. And so I talk to people who are stuck inside those stories. And as a rhetorician, my whole thing is like, you know, look what stories you're stuck in and figure out if that's good for you or bad for you. But you have been stuck in that story by somebody, regardless of whether you think it's true or not.
Well, and just me observing what happened during this last political cycle, I was amazed by how many people said they were against one candidate and for the other candidate. And then you ask those people, okay, I get that. Why are you for the candidate you're for? And most of them couldn't tell you why.
Yeah, most people don't know Biden at all. They don't know anything about Biden other than that. And they didn't really give much information. They just ran him on empathy. He's way more humanistic than Trump.
Biden got more votes because he was not Trump than because they were pro Biden.
Yeah, and that's the way you run. If you have a villain, if somebody has been clearly villainized, then you run a hero. That's it.
Well, that's why Trump won in 2016. He was
Hillary was a horrible candidate. She had been so villainized over the years. She may be the most slandered person in all of American history. Like, and it doesn't matter whether it's true or not true. She has been turned into a villain for a massive portion of America. They should never have run her. She's the only one that would have lost to Trump.
Yeah, exactly. And she had been in our lives since the early 90s. And so those of us of a certain age remember that, you know, all the Whitewater stuff and all the everything all through the years and Benghazi. And oh my gosh, like there's
She's caring too much. And, you know, the right is very good. So one of my projects is as I'm building out, you know, different courses, and one is like, here, I'll show you all the playbook of the right. And it's not that it's indicative or just the right has to use these, but these are what they have used rhetorically to gain rhetorical power. And part of that is like, if there's a dominant paradigm, you gain power by attacking them. And it's a slander power. Like the right slanders like nobody has ever slandered before. They're so good at it, you know? And Hillary was a 30, 40 year recipient of that. Again, doesn't matter whether it's true or not. It's you're finding negatives and you're saying them about a person. And they just hammered her with it.
Well, and I'll give Hillary one thing that Joe Biden hasn't even come close to. She had the enthusiasm. There were people, I'm with her, I think was her slogan in 2016.
Yeah, she wasn't going anywhere. She was going to, sooner or later, she was going to be president, you know?
Yeah. Well, she knew when she was with Bill in the 90s, she's like, I'm on a trajectory to be president of the United States someday. And so it was kind of almost a coronation. And I think she had the expectation, which is why when Trump beat her, it was such a shock. And there was such this reaction to it that is unlike anything I ever saw in American politics. I mean, literally for 5 years, they have consistently tried to find something on Trump. And now they're trying to go after him because some people supposedly were influenced by something he said. I mean, there's a lot of...
So you a Trump, let me ask you, because Biden, I don't think is really even, I call him like, he's not really that worthy of a conversation rhetorically because they did so little with him. Right. And he just rode this anti-Trump wave.
Yes. You know,
there's so much animosity towards Trump. And are you thinking that that's created by the media?
Well, there's a lot of media influence there. There's a lot of social media influence there. I mean, the whole Hunter Biden story, they just killed. They just didn't want anybody to see anything about it. And there's always an October surprise. And that was it, this last election cycle. And it got totally washed out. You couldn't even find it online. And in fact, there were some surveys after the election where they asked people who voted for Joe Biden, hey, have you heard of any of these stories? And they brought up Hunter Biden. They brought up a lot of things that had been squelched by social media and media itself. And they're like, oh my gosh, I didn't know any of those things. And then they said, how many of you would have changed your vote? It's like 20% of them. That was enough to swing it that Trump would have won. So
my
my
favorite story of that was they were talking to some woman in Iowa, I think at the caucuses, who had just voted for Pete Buttigieg. And they're like, you know, you realize like you voted for the first openly gay candidate in American history. You know, did that matter to you or whatever? And she's like, he's gay? What do you mean he's gay? I would never have voted for him if I knew he was gay. So it is interesting, like, you know, how much the American population votes without knowing what they're voting for.
You know who has been shafted the most, both in 16 and in 20, is Bernie Sanders. The guy would have won easily both elections.
I think so. I think like the, you know, you talk about the reactivities of what America is. One of the things about our politics rhetorically too, is that we get tired of a rhetoric, you know, when it's dominant, when we hear it too much. And so the rhetoric that has not been allowed into power yet is the sort of Bernie, you know, kind of hyper-libertarian, you know, hyper-social, social democrat, that kind of stuff has not been allowed into power yet. We've had corporate democracy, you know, Clinton, Obama, those guys were basically corporate-friendly democracy.
Bush would be in there as well.
Yeah, all those guys. And we've never had, you know, a real... like European socialist running the country for 4 years to see what, and in some ways Biden's closer to that. Everybody still wants him to be Obama in that, but he's got way more empathy and he's opening up way more doors to that kind of European socialism than I've ever seen from a, you know, guy coming in.
Well, Kamala, I think, will heavily influence that as well. And I think Bernie is behind the scenes. I think they brokered some kind of a deal with Bernie. They're right.
Yeah.
Step aside. We're going to make sure that lots of things that you want to have happen. And then you've got young blood in the Democrat Party, like AOC and other ones out there. They're going to make their voice heard. Like, if people wanted to know what European socialism looks like, we're about to find out.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's always an Americanized version of that stuff coming, but it's something that, you know, the millennials have grown up on. You know, they're much more comfortable with that kind of sort of multi-democracy, you know, multiracial, multi-gender, all that kind of multi-democracy, which is sort of what, you know, that kind of left-leaning socialism has become. And again, it's never been allowed into power in this country, and it may never get there. You know, it's a tough sell in a capitalism to bring that kind of social democracy to power, because the capitalist structure doesn't really trust it, because it thinks it's going to work too much against capitalism. So, you know, we'll see if it ever gets that kind of, you know, backing. You can get some senators, you can get some energy behind it, but can it take over, you know, the party the way that the far right has taken over the Republican Party? I'm not sure, you know?
Dude, I want to throw something back at you, because I think we are in an unprecedented situation. We're about to have a brand new president who has a radically different agenda for America than the previous administration. And we're also all under the auspice of about a year's worth of consistent fear being fed into us over this crazy virus thing. And so when people are in a fearful state, rhetoric is more easily taken in and absorbed, anything to let up the pain of what's happening in their life. So what's your thought on, and I don't mean to interview you, but this is in my brain, what's your thought on like what role the fear factor over the virus is having on people's receptivity or rejection of what's about to happen?
Yeah, again, we're in this kind of unprecedented human experience. You know, the way that we're unprecedented in our communication distribution now with social media. We've never lived through a pandemic. You know, no country in the world has ever had to deal with this in the way that, you know, we've had to deal with it. It's destroying people's ability to do civic, you know, discussion. You know, like the masks, I think are really interesting because before the masks, the only physical way to decide whether you hated somebody because they were evil was based on how they drove. You could just see a bad driver and feel that instant surge of hate, you know, and complete animosity. And that's why road rage is there, because it's right. A physical demonstration, as opposed to like, if you see 100 people, you don't know which ones to hate. You don't know which ones are the villains, but the way they drive will tell you. And now, like Bruce Willis yesterday got, you know, photographed at the CVS in LA, refusing to wear, you know, his bandana, even though it's around his neck, he wouldn't pull it over his nose and mouth. And he went from, you know, just this actor guy, and now they've added in a new stain to his character. You know, will it become significant? I don't know. But the masks let you see the people that are refusing to follow a civic dictate. You know, it's like driving the speed limit is a civic dictate. And if you refuse to do that, that allows us to move you over into this person who doesn't care about anything. You're an asshole. And the masks have done that. And I think, you know, that the whole pandemic thing has changed people's, you know, judgments on each other very radically, well, and very fast.
And think about the treatment that Bruce Willis is getting now because he didn't wear a mask in CVS. And the outrage, so-called outrage that's over that, and wanting to maybe cancel him or whatever. And then like juxtapose that to Mel Gibson circa a decade or so ago with that racist rant he went on, and oh my God, and he's still working in Hollywood. So it's like,
it took him a while, but yeah, villains are, it took him a while to get back, but yeah, once you turned. So again, the cool thing about rhetoric, which is going to be, it's really useful for people when they learn this stuff, is that you just look at the templates, and these are just story templates, and every story has heroes and villains, right? And victims. So if you just apply a story, you know, template to what's going on, all that's really happening is we're trading off heroes and villains constantly in politics, and then we're pointing at victims. And so you don't want to be a villain. You don't want to let people make you a villain, but they want to make you a villain, you know, and that's the struggle.
We lift people up to kick them off their pedestal.
Well, story-wise, it has great value. If you're a hero in a culture like Biden is a hero right now. Like, he is the exalted hero coming in to save, you know, against Mordor and King of the Rings, you know, whatever it was, that he's going to save us. You know, he's the white knight coming in, even though he's 900 years old and he's falling off his horse. He's going to save us from the darkness that has taken over the last 4 years. And it's a story. That doesn't mean, again, it's right or wrong. It's just powerful. So like you, like, and this has happened, I see a lot of people like the, you know, you're talking about the, you know, treatments coming up for COVID and, you know, all that kind of stuff and whether we should believe it or not. Deniers, like of any sort, like the joke I did at the beginning of the show about people are going to end up denying the insurrection happened. They're going to say it's all CGI. These guys weren't even there. You know, they're trying to do it right away with, it's Antifa, you know. They weren't really going to kill anybody. They're all trying to take the story down, you know, and put up a new story in there. And deniers are one of the characters that a lot of Americans hate, really hate. And it's a tough villainy to get away from.
Well, and it's a convenient way that if you don't have an answer, you just deny. And people feel very comfortable in being the anti, even if they're pro. Some people are just like, I don't care. Let's just take the anti.
Yeah.
Let's be higher.
That's huge in America. Like, essentially, Trump, against looking at story, he's an anti-hero, which if you look at our media, like in the last 10 years, we've really raised up anti-heroes, which are heroes. They're basically good, but they do a lot of horrible things too. And that's Trump. Like, a lot of people voted for him because, yeah, he's going to cause trouble. I want him to get in there and just, you know, cause some problems for all these politicians.
And he
they
did.
Like that. He certainly did.
And he was successful. And I wouldn't even call him conservative. He was very populist as a candidate, just as Bernie Sanders is also a populist candidate. Joe Biden this time around was also populist in as much as he was the antithesis of Trump. I think Kamala is hard left.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know. Like, I think the question is going to, people need to learn what the left is going to do. Like, if the left is in power, what are the actual policies? Where are they going to spend the money? What are they going to do? Then you can judge them. Right now, it's still theoretical.
Well, it's not theoretical. If you look at, say, the Senate record for Kamala, she was literally voted the most liberal member of the Senate, even further to the left of Bernie Sanders and some of the more liberal ones. And so we have some hard evidence based on past, but you're right. Like, let's see what happens. Let's see what you do with it now that you're in there. And that's what has a lot on the far right very scared, because a lot of those policies are the very antithesis of the foundational principles of what they believe. So there's kind of this, the two factions going on. And I've heard, you know, we're headed for civil war. And I'm like, okay, but you have ebbs and flows in kind of cycles of these things. Like, we had, 8 years of Barack Obama, and he brought in hope and change, and he was exciting for a lot of people. And then kind of his albatross, his kind of thing that got a lot of people pissed off was the healthcare thing that he implemented, Obamacare, Affordable Care Act, whatever you call it. And there were some people that loved it. Oh, thank God, I can finally afford health insurance. And then you had another narrative, like you were talking about, the right's very good at vilifying. They vilified Obamacare, and Obamacare became this beast that kind of followed
death squads. Followed
into Trump's presidency. I'm going to end Obamacare. He didn't, but he said he would. And so you're always going to have those kind of things come up as well.
Yeah. And so are you a Trump supporter, or where are you at on this?
I think Trump is a very complicated human being. I am not opposed to him. I think he did some very good things in office. Lowest unemployment for the African-American community, I thought was amazing. That didn't happen under Barack Obama, the first Black president. It happened under supposedly the most racist president we've ever had. So I think he did good things. And like I was talking about earlier, even the most biggest enemy I have in my life, I can think of a few things good about them. And I wish the media would do that. And I wish us in general as a society would do that, not to take an all or nothing proposition. I had problems with Obama as well, but I liked some things about Obama. So I think support is kind of a loaded word. Support, yes, there were certain things I think he did well. I think that we probably could have gotten more done if there was less vitriol towards the man. And I think that also shaped people's opinions about what they thought of him.
I'm curious, like, do you think the vitriol was just because the left and the media and all that stuff, or do you think he earned it? I mean, he's the most vitriolic. He's an incredibly vitriolic person. This wasn't a reaction. He's been vitriolic for 40 years in America.
Well, you called me, I'm a rabble rouser and all that. So what'd you call me earlier? What was that word?
Vitriolic?
No. You called me volatile. Something. Paleo world.
In the culture, you're a volatile character in that culture. You get reactions.
So you called me volatile.
For other people, not you, not as a person, but other people are volatile about you.
Right, right, right. Yeah. So I was a rabble rouser, I suppose. And I see Trump in the same way. He can be a rabble rouser because he's rough around the edges. He doesn't fit the prototype of what a president should be, whatever that means. And so I think he rubbed people the wrong way, partly his fault, yes, but also the way that he was characterized. I think he was a characterization of himself in people's eyes and not necessarily the man.
Well, like I said, we have 40 years of relationship with Donald Trump. He was a clown for the first 30 years or so.
I remember on Oprah Winfrey when he was on in the 80s and do, like he was always this eccentric kind of guy. But like, look, he was very successful. He became a billionaire and did his thing to earn that money and be what he did. I think what's kind of lost is he didn't have to run for president. What was his purpose in running? Like he ran under the auspice of, well, all the politicians are fucking things up. Let me go in there and see what I can do.
You know, he started running for president in like 2000. Like he,
no, I get that. Well, he ran
forever and he never could get in.
Like in the 1980s. Yeah, in the 1980s, he was trying to run for president. Yeah, so
he had a bigger need than like, oh, I want to clean up the country. Like his ego, like he wants to be the center of things and he's good at it.
But let me finish this thought. So when he entered the office in 2017, he had a value, a worth of like $4.2 billion. Well, today it's about $2.1 billion, and I'm not crying. He's still got plenty of money. But he like sacrificed half of his wealth to be president. And I would ask people that would be opposed to him and think he was this horrible human being, okay, why would he sacrifice $2 billion in the value of his wealth just to be president? Like what did he get out of that?
Okay, awesome question. This way, again, like, so let's move over Alpha Story and we'll move over into logic world for rhetoric, you know, sort of looking at claims and evidence so we can reach a conclusion, whether a conclusion is valid or not. So you made a couple of claims there. He was worth $4.2 billion. He's lost half his wealth. Why would somebody, you know, lose that much money, you know, do something that's going to make them lose that much money? So if people were going back into that, and I think this is where the media gets, you know, crunched, like he makes a claim like that. I'm worth $4.2 billion. He's been making over claims about what he's worth again, since the 80s. That's part of his thing. Like there's this great article from, I can't remember where it's from, a magazine did a profile on him way back and basically saying, you know, he's worth maybe like at that time, like maybe $50 million, but he was claiming he was worth like $1.2 billion. And he got very upset and sued them for saying he was worth less than that. But they showed very detailed, like, you know, all this debt, here's all the stuff. You can't say that you're worth $1.2 billion when you're in $1.7 billion worth of debt, stuff like that, right? So when you look at that claim that Trump's made, that's made about Trump, that he's worth a ton of money, $5 billion, is that true? Is he worth that money?
I mean, only he knows that, him and his accountant know that question.
Right. And he won't. And that was the original thing with Hillary. He won't release proof.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. I don't know. I just feel like, and this happens with every politician. I think the same thing happened to Barack Obama. Oh my gosh, he's a slick talker. He knows how to talk well, but that's all he is. He's an empty suit outside of he talks real pretty. George W. Bush, they made to look like a buffoon, doesn't know how to talk right. And so
I don't know. He inhabited that one pretty well.
Hold on. That wrote in the coattails of his papa. That's the only reason he got his name was the same as his famous father. And so that's how he got in there. You're right. He was a bit of an idiot at times.
Bill Clinton. Good at it. He was a likable idiot. I got to give him that, man. He's the best guy since he left office. People are like, that guy's all right. You know?
And Bill Clinton was a known philanderer. Like he wasn't even hiding. He was a philanderer, even in the Oval Office.
Also and good at it. You know,
he had a ability. What?
I mean, he was good at that. That was,
he
you know,
good at that. He was good at talking as well. And he was, you know, I think his nickname was Slick Willie because he literally got out of every.
These are all like, these are all caricatures, like you were saying earlier, of these guys.
That's right.
These are all slanders. They're all caricatures. They're all cartoon versions of them. So if we go back to like the claim about Trump, you know, worth, he's a billionaire, $5 billion, has golden toilets and all this stuff. That is, that true is the question. And so like in rhetoric, this is, those three words are like your superpower. Is that true? You know, and we have to go in and look at it and go, okay, well, let's see if we can prove that's true or not. And then we can make a valid conclusion. But everybody like this whole idea, like they're going now, you know, they keep trying to go into Trump and say, look, it's fine if you claim this, just show us the proof. And he won't show you the proof, ergo in logic, that probably means he's lying.
Okay.
Because why wouldn't you show us the proof?
Do you think he has lost income while he's been president of the United States?
How?
Okay, but every single former president goes on to become tens of millionaire, almost close to billionaire.
Like, it's easy to make money once you've been president.
Yeah, but do you think Trump's going to be able to recoup that money once he's an ex-president? I don't know. There's so much.
How did he lose money?
So, I mean, I'm not his business advisor or anything.
But that's another claim that you hear people saying he's lost money by being right in office.
I'm going to use logic here. I'm assuming that how he lost money was he wasn't able to be in the day-to-day operations of his normal businesses where he would be making said money. He probably still had people working. Most of his family worked in the White House, so I don't know who was running his companies if it wasn't a Trump.
Well, there's plenty of people that work for Trump, plenty of really smart business guys that work for Trump. But, are you saying like he had a bunch of bad business guys, you know, that he left behind and they lost all his money?
I don't know is the answer. So
I don't know either.
The point being that I think he had created such a juggernaut of his business surrounding his family members, and all of the family members were working in his presidency. And so if you took away your most prized possession in your business to help you run the country, it ergo logic would tell you, okay, those are my best. Who I left behind may not be as good, or maybe the decisions weren't as decisive because he wasn't allowed to be involved in those, being the POTUS, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, I can see.
That's all logical. You know, you can always say, yeah, that's those, all those things are possible that you just said. He's lost money. His family is somehow all geniuses who would have, you know, made more money if he'd have left them there. You know, all those things are possible, but if we actually, again, look at it, you look at the opposite claims, and this is the fun part to me of rhetoric, because it's not about, you know, whether you vote for Trump or Biden or whatever, it's about the quality of the messaging, you know? So I think with Trump, we have problems that we don't have very good quality messaging. And you're pointing it out on the left. You're like, hey, these are bad messages. All you do is say negative stuff about the guy. There's got to be some good things. And people be like, that's probably true, you know? And on the other side, the left looking at the right's messaging about him is that, no, that's incredibly flawed too, because he won't release evidence of these things. So we can't judge it.
Right. And I think the post-election kind of rhetoric that was out there as well, let's talk about that a second if you want to.
Yeah.
Where all stop the steal hashtag created.
I called it stop the squeal. I got tired of hearing it.
But like, even when they polled Americans, they found obviously a vast majority of people who voted for Trump thought that it was stolen, somewhere like 70%. Even Democrats, there was like a 25% said, yeah, something went on in this election, and independents, it was 50%. And so there was a good bit of skepticism that went on. Where did that come from? Well, part of it was, okay, there was this swell of people saying, oh my gosh, outrage, oh my gosh, da 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 da. So that got out there. Then you started seeing video images of things that might have, could have, would have, should have, could have happened. And then all the media, that's the alternative media, the alt-right kind of media, kind of promoting some of those things as well. And meanwhile, the press is all saying, nope, it's over. President-elect Joe Biden, it's over. It's over. It's over. AP has called it. And then every single social media post has put that up there, even though technically it wasn't done until last week when they met in the Congress. But like, all of that fed into the narrative continuing. And so you got this divide based on the rhetoric of, okay, there seemed to be something going on, but then nothing ever happened with that.
So what's your position on that? Where do you fall in that?
So my position is we needed more lights being brought to the things that were being claimed.
And like there never you didn't consider the lawsuits and the courts saying there's nothing to find here. You didn't consider that to be an investigation?
No, they never looked at any of the evidence. It was all procedural dismissals in the court.
Let's look at that claim. Let's look at the claim, because again, this is rhetoric is just about truth, right? It's totally fine to make any claim you want, but like in Georgia or whatever, they recounted, you know, the ballots three times.
Yeah, but they recounted supposedly all of those ones that were pulled out from under the. See, I'm saying you don't acquiesce.
You don't know, because there's. So here's the thing: like, if you are about destroying somebody else's argument, right, or destroying somebody else's story, which is what the right does, and the left tries to do it too. It's not hard to destroy, to put doubt into somebody else's story, right? That's why courts, you know, one of their levels of judgment is beyond a status of reasonable doubt.
Right.
So the question is, we don't use those kind of courtroom evidence things in public debate. So is this reasonable doubt about the election, or is it unreasonable doubt?
That's right. I suppose it depends on what your angle is here. If you're only looking at facts, I think there are some inconvenient facts that make it a little more challenging. Let's go to Pennsylvania. Like there was a certain number of absentee ballots that were mailed out, and they got back over 400,000 more in the mail than they mailed out. So
yeah, but this is where you're getting your, let's go back to your original thing about sources. Like that's a Trump point.
Okay, but no, it can be provable. Go look it up. I mean, there are definitely various sources. And again, I'm not advocating Joe Biden's the president. Go get a big boy.
No, this is fun to me. Like we're supposed to look at it and make decisions about what is reasonable doubt, what isn't, what is credible evidence, and what is not credible evidence. And so what about the guy who was it Georgia? The guy who, the election official, and he was a Republican who got up and went point by point, you know, for like 3 hours over everything that Trump had said on that phone call with the Secretary of State, and showed why everything he said was untrue. Was that persuasive to you or not?
I mean, it was interesting information for sure. And honestly, I did not listen to the entire refutal of all those points. So, but I did see, I guess, a recap of it. And yeah, I mean, there's certainly things. Something happened in this election, and
finish your thought there. Okay, so let's stay on this guy, and then we'll move back to that. So that guy, was that persuasive to you or not, that he went through all those things point by point and showed you, here's exactly what we did, here's what Trump said, and why it's not true?
So who is the guy? So who is the guy?
It was a white-haired guy from Georgia.
The Secretary of State?
I think he was in charge of elections. He was the secretary in charge of elections.
Oh, the federal election or the state election official. Okay.
Yeah. So he was like, that was his job, was to oversee all of it. And he's like, I was there. I did every one of these. Here's exactly what we did.
But see, then you go, okay, who's this guy?
Yeah,
this is where
look at the source. Sure.
This gets a little bit tricky, because when you have players involved that you don't know who they are, there's an automatic skepticism that gets in. Let me know who this guy is. It's not like we have some name value to this guy. We never even heard of this guy until this happened. And so there's a bit of skepticism just built into the unknown of this guy. So that's part
of you don't find it like it doesn't help you believe him that, you know, he's Secretary of State, you know, of elections for Georgia, and he's done this for like 25 years, and he's never been accused of any wrongdoing. He's a Republican. None of that is credible enough, or is it just you don't know that stuff?
I suppose because of some of the statements that had been made from the governor, Kemp, and others, they're kind. And again, I'm not taking this position. I'm articulating positions that I have heard other people say. So. It's one of those things where people hear kind of the betrayal, so to speak, from these people that supposedly should be on Trump's side, whatever that means. And then for this to come out like this, there's a lot of layers to this conversation. And we didn't even talk about software and how people have skepticism about that.
That's what I'm
and
saying. It's far beyond our ability to judge, right? It's far beyond our ability to judge. We don't know elections. We don't know these people. We don't know these machines. We don't know any of it. So we are literally sitting here unable to make good, rational, logical decisions.
But here is the overriding thing, Dan, that I think people listening right now to this podcast, what do we do now? Because there is a segment of the population who thinks this was stolen, who thinks this was rigged, who thinks that Donald Trump should have gotten a second term. There's a bunch of people that are like, oh my gosh, they did shenanigans to get people in the Senate. So now there's a Senate majority. So there is this skepticism of a very large number of people. And I don't think everybody in that, however many millions of people, I don't think they're all stupid. They're all mind numb robots. But there is a concern now that you've got this huge section of America that's going, okay, this new administration is not legit. So how do you convince those people that now this is your president and you need to be supportive?
Well, I think one of the things that you're finding right now, if you watch any of the debate, I don't know, the impeachment debate, it's always interesting to me. I hate politics. Politics in general is just boring and overblown. And America has never liked politics. We've never enjoyed that kind of talk. We find it empty and whatever. And, you know, I'll say one thing good about Trump is Trump changed political talk. He added in reality show entertainment to it. Yeah. And it just blew it open. You know, it's a very different way of talking these days.
Well, and thank you for saying that, because I think what's getting lost in this transition is the legacy of this man, because there are people who really, really, really love him and people who really, really, really hate him. So this polarizing figure who now American politics will never be the same again because of this 4 years that he was in office. So like him or not, you have to admit he made an indelible impression on our culture.
Yeah, again, going to the end of a lot of these things and making a conclusion, you know, I think is where you get into problems. I'm more interested usually in the process of getting there. So for me, like Trump, people always ask about my politics, and I vote for the nicest people. I vote for the most fun people or the funniest people, you know, that are running, especially like nice. Like I'll just pick the nicest person because I figure they'll make the nicest choices.
Huh? So Bernie Sanders, 2016.
You know, I think Bernie Sanders actually is a nice person. Like if you look at, he's been in, you know, the Congress for 7,000 years and trying to do things for wherever he's from, Vermont. Is it Vermont?
Yeah.
Yeah. And
he's got the syrup.
Yeah. And he's, you know, he champions kind of the underdog and he's working class. Like he wants to help the working class and that's what I'm from. So,
and he looks like a Muppet when he's talking, he looks like
always
a Muppet.
Talking, he's always irritated. He's always bear. Like, rah, rah, rah.
It looks like a Muppet.
I'd hate to screw up his order if I was his waiter. but like my politics are, I like nice people, I like good people to run my institutions, you know? And so when I look around, like Trump to me is not a good person. He's not a nice person. He's, you know, I don't know if it's because he worked in business for so long or he's from New York or he came from a certain background, but niceness is not his thing.
Well, the New Yorker part is a big part of that turnoff for a lot of middle America. But look, middle America loves him. Middle America was his core base. Like I live here.
I'm just saying, like, for me, like, I don't like rednecks. I grew up in Kentucky. I don't like mean rednecks either. I don't like mean people. And Trump, you know, he always tries to portray it as I'm just reacting to people being bad to me. That's why I'm being so whatever. But he goes after people. You know, he's an attack dog. He'll say anything to get, you know, the effect that he's after on somebody. And that's just not nice. That's just not nice people. You know,
your reaction Trump is tripping me out though. Like I can appreciate it, by the way. And you do lean slightly. I can tell you're center, but you lean slightly left. I'm center and slightly.
I'm the fun, right. I'm fun country. Conservatives are not that fun.
Who in the Catholic?
I grew up in a conservative community. Not that fun. Yeah.
So this will be a fun question. Who in the political realm do you think would be the funnest person in the existing political realm to be the leader of the free world?
Oh gosh, you know, a politician, I would go outside of politics and I would pull in like a comedian.
Bill Burr.
I like Burr. I really like his comedy. I respect what he does. Jim Gaffigan, no, he doesn't interest me very much.
Nah.
I'd have to think about it a little bit, but
Jeff Dunham.
Oh God, no. although it would be kind of funny to watch puppets talk to us for 4 years.
Walter, let Walter do a press conference every day.
That cranky old bastard. I worked with Jeff Dunham when I was at Best Damn Sports Show. He used to do our show a lot.
And, yes.
I almost wrote some stuff for him for a while. We did a show together at the Atlanta Punchline way back when, but not my kind of comedy. I don't know. I'd probably look around for somebody outside of politics. Somebody that's got a little more pop. You know, who's a little more interesting to listen to?
The Rock?
Nah, doesn't interest me. I don't think he's a very, you know, what I would consider to be a smart guy. I like really smart comedy, you know?
Although, Kanye ran this year.
He's crazy. He's crazy. There was a guy died a few years ago, Patrice O'Neill. You know Patrice? Great comic, and you're just a really good thinker and just, you know, hardcore deviant. He'd been an interesting president.
You know who I still wish was around, and I see a lot of his videos going around the internet, is George Carlin. Man.
Yeah, Carlin was a thinker. He's one of the most thinky comics ever.
Yeah, I watched one of his older sets from about 15 years ago last weekend, and oh my goodness, like, the man was such a soothsayer. Like, he knew what was coming.
He's been a good, you know, taking bites out of power forever.
He was a master of the whole concept of rhetoric and understanding how it works and understanding how we're kind of being used and abused by that rhetoric. Yeah. And so
he was a comic genius and had, you know, a little bit of actual intellectual genius to him too. Like, if you ever go back in again, I ran into this in paleo, the very first paleo effects. I was one of the MCs and I would do panels, and I set up a panel for the second one. And I told them I wanted to do something about teaching the paleo people how to sell paleo, how to convince people to follow paleo. And I was like, I'll put the panel together. And they're like, well, we'll find other people. And they put three Harvard psychologists up there with me. And, you know, they all introduced themselves and got down to me. And I was the last one. I'm like, well, none of these people should be up here. I said, they're psychologists. They're not rhetoricians. I said, if you want to sell rhetoric, America's already told you how to sell things. Create a you know, paleo Hooters, call it Rumps, you know, and like just sell really good meat, you know, because America knows how to sell sex, alcohol, and food, and just use that instead of all this kind of you know, it's healthy and nobody cares. And they looked at me like I was crazy. I'm like, yeah, well, there you go.
And apparently you need bathtubs outside holding hands to sell erectile dysfunction medications. That was the stupidest commercial I ever saw.
What else are you going to show, Jimmy? What are you going to show? You can't show a big erection. You can't
show
what our pill does. You got to show them bathtubs.
Look, honey, I got an eggplant from the garden today. Ooh.
Yeah, well, you can't show them in the same bathtub either, because it's conservative America, which goes back to my point. They're not any fun. Sex, you think, is still fun. Why is it is it restricted at all in our TV?
Do you think we're still a conservative country?
Oh God, yes. It's horribly conservative, this country. Look at all the stuff you can't openly do.
Not unilaterally, in pockets.
Well, it depends on what you want to, you know, again, this is getting back to rhetoric. You pull up terms like conservative or liberal or socialist. And nobody knows how to define them. They all have different meanings. Like, to me, conservative is anybody who, you know, doesn't like the word fuck, doesn't like to have, you know, doesn't like porn, doesn't like people doing drugs. Like, that's conservative.
I think we've shifted far away from that. I would say 10, 15 years ago, yeah, I think we're more of a mix now. And this election kind of proved it. There's a mix of philosophies about what America should be. And so you've got the people that are fuck, shit, pussy, dick. Like, they're all over, like, all the forbidden terms. And
yeah, but they're not things. Running corporations. They're not in churches.
Yeah.
They won't let you talk like that at work.
Yeah.
One of my other things, I have all these little nonprofits that I want to set up. And one is Comedian Americans. Like, I think comedians are our most oppressed group. Like, you can't say your comic thoughts in regular life or you get fired or beat up.
Yeah. I watched a documentary on that on Amazon Prime Video a couple weeks ago. Can't Take a Joke, I think is what it's called. And it had all the big name people and talking about how they now have to like self-censor themselves. And they had Gilbert Gottfried, who lost his Geico duck commercial gig over something he had said that was literally, it was obvious it was a joke, but it was taken so literally. I don't know how as a stand-up comedian you even handle that anymore.
Well, everybody's like, oh, this is new. That's what I'm saying. Like, okay, so the left is now getting reactionary, right? And that's what they're talking about, cancel culture and all this shit. The left, the far left is now reactionary against things that it's been hypersensitized to. The far right and the right itself, even the moderate right, is incredibly sensitized to a lot of things that you can't talk about and you've never been able to really talk about. Like, I did a lot of corporate comedy when I was doing comedy full-time. And you have to be so careful about saying anything that might inflame or irritate anybody on a conservative side. This is not even the liberal side. So like comedians have always had to deal with, you know, the conservative forces censoring them and getting very upset all the way back to Lenny Bruce and, you know, being arrested for saying, you know, fuck or whatever it was, you know, so that's always been there, but now the left is doing it to them too. And the comedians are like, I got no place else to stand, man. You know, so like the right is going cancel culture. I'm like, yeah, it's on both sides. Don't give me that bullshit about the right is, you know, being oppressed by cancel culture. Everybody's being oppressed by cancel culture on the left and oppressed by it on the right, which is my whole thing about, hey, everybody relax.
It's a strange culture we're in. I wish you comedians could get a free speech card, so to speak, of
right,
basically say whatever you want. And really everybody should have that because that's First Amendment. But I think you guys especially, because you're trained at what you're doing. You like some of the most interesting comedy has been like satire of political stuff. And it's
it's great. Yeah. I love that kind of, it's yeah. Well, I think again, I want to pull us back here in just a minute, but to the thing that we were talking about with, you know, kind of the way we're represented or everybody's represented now. But like, you know, if you did allow comedians to do more in the serious world, it would have amazingly good effects. Like put a hardcore comedian in as one of the presidential debate moderators, yes, and see what kind of questions and answers you get.
Well, Joe Rogan offered it in this last election. He said, come on my show, you guys, we'll host you in my building. And he's a very adept comedian. I think you like him.
Comedy's not, I don't do negative talk about comedians. I have my judgments about comics.
Well,
I have my favorites.
He's a podcaster.
Completely viable. Well, he's a great podcaster. He can act. He can do comedy. I'm amazed by the guy. Yeah.
MMA.
Yeah, sideline he's super reporter. Talented. Like my problem, Jimmy, is like when everybody ends up, we end all talking about this stuff and you know, all the people in public end up talking about it, but they've, again, it goes back to the paleo thing. They've got no training in rhetoric whatsoever. So everybody's trying to do all their politic talk. They're trying to do all this different stuff and make decisions. And we've done no training. Like you said, at the very beginning of this, nobody's getting educated before they launch into this stuff. And so they end up in this world where they're making like strong claims with bad evidence, you know? And I'm like, no, you can't do that. You can't do that and get to good conclusions, you know?
So how do you fix that, Dan? I mean, do you have like a board of facts that like I mean, it seems to me like there's always going to be the opinion people out there that are going to have an opinion for opinion's sake.
Rather, yeah, you gotta, that's part of the reason why I started Rhetoric Warriors, is people need training. You know, it's not that you have to be perfect. It's not that you can't have an opinion, but if we're going to do a democracy where you're persuading other people and you are being persuaded by other people, you better get some training in it, because there are a lot of really effective, unethical persuaders out there. And you're just as susceptible to it as anybody else. Doesn't matter how smart you are. Doesn't matter how good a person you are. They are really good at using unethical persuasion techniques. And ultimately, that's the whole goal of Rhetoric Warriors, is ethical only persuasion. And if we get trained to that, then we'll be fine. You can believe whatever you want to believe. As long as people are talking in ethical ways, then you can make good decisions. But when you have a space dominated by unethical persuaders, it becomes very difficult to make good decisions.
Well, and the problem is the vast majority of the population is unethical persuaders. And so until enough people are exposed to the ethics of this, it's going to be an uphill battle in the meantime.
Yeah. And that's what I said. You can go to Rhetoric Warriors and take courses in it. Part of this is, if I get enough people trained, they can call people out when they're doing unethical persuasion and help retrain them so that, you know, they don't have the influence and power that they do. Watching the debate today, you know, the impeachment debate, all sorts of unethical persuasion going on. And the fact that those guys, you know, are at the highest level of American government and getting on camera across the world is watching this, and they're doing unethical persuasion, that's a problem.
What I hate about this whole conversation is there is no middle ground. You're either categorized in the far left or categorized in the far right. There is no like in between, which is where I would see these ethical arbiters of the truth to live, is kind of in that middle of considering all the sides and then making the argument based on the facts that might have an element from this side, an element from that side. But everybody wants to just split you off into one category or the other. And I'll tell you, last year when the Black Lives Matter stuff was happening, I started talking openly on my work. And I had people say, oh my God, you're the biggest leftist in the world. My goodness, how dare you hate America? And I'm like, wow, like great way assuming what you think I believe. And then when all the virus stuff started happening and that was becoming more, I was putting out some things about masks and people were like, oh my gosh, you're the biggest right-wing wacko lunatic I've ever heard. I'm like, how am I both extremely leftist and extremely right at the same time? It's just amazing how people are so reactionary based on one thing rather than trying to look at the totality of everything you've done. And everybody that knows me knows I'm a rabble rouser. I'm going to stir shit. That's what I do. But with a purpose to try to get people to think.
Yeah. And you know, when you have when you go back to judgments of people about where they are and whether they're villains or heroes, are they a moral entity, you know, or not? Like you're anchoring your morality in this idea of, I just want people to think, right?
Pretty much.
Which is it's a good morality, you know. I just want people to think. And what I want is I just want people to understand the difference between unethical and ethical persuasion. And to quit using stuff they're getting from unethical persuaders to make up their minds. Because it's a super dangerous system.
And absolutism.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, we can talk, you can get into, you know, sort of flaws of outgoing stuff, but the simplest way, the simplest dividing rod is this an ethical persuader or an unethical persuader? And Donald Trump is an unethical persuader. And I'll show you my definition. This is why I've got courses on this. Like, here are the techniques unethical persuaders use. And just one, just for him, is he's a slanderer. He slanders other people, which means he finds something and he insults them incredibly well with it, but he insults them.
Crooked
that's,
Hillary.
That's slander. Killer, you know, he did it to anybody who runs against him gets it. Like anybody.
Yeah, Ted Cruz got Lion Ted.
Lion Ted, you know, he went after Cruz, you know, Marco Rubio tried to do, you know, a response to the Democratic talk or whatever. And they couldn't drink water. And so Trump made fun of that. That's unethical persuasion. That's slander.
Crazy Bernie. Yeah, he had a little name for everybody. He
insults everybody. And that's not ethical persuasion.
Rush Limbaugh has done that for as long as he's been on the radio.
Yeah, and Rush Limbaugh is an unethical persuader. By definition, like I will show you, like here are the 50 techniques that unethical persuaders use. And if you do that, you are now an unethical persuader, which means I'm not going to make my judgments based on what you say. You have to get back over into ethical stuff and I'll listen to you again. You know, I don't care who it is, but be ethical or I'm not listening.
So Dan, give me one quality of an ethical persuader.
Oh, like super transparency. Like if somebody asks you a question about you, your politics, your finances, what you've done, what you believe, any of that, you give them full information, straight up.
Do you feel like I've been an unethical or ethical persuader on your podcast today?
You know, I think, Jimmy, I think you're an ethical person. I think you're a moral person. I think you're trying always to get to good things for people. That's one of the reasons I've always respected you. I respected you when you do, you know, alternative health, when you talk to all these experts, you're trying to find good answers for people that are struggling. And that is a moral thing to do in the world. I think sometimes, and again, I haven't stayed up with, you know, what you're doing now, but I've seen this happen to a lot of people in across a lot of different industries, but especially in alternative health. They're susceptible to unethical persuasion systems because exactly what you said, they've had direct experience with liars, like huge, powerful, corporate, hidden, invisible, never questioned liars. And that's massively unethical. And so you don't trust things. So you end up not trusting a lot. And sometimes I see them not trusting the things that they actually should trust.
Can someone get into something being an ethical person, but then turn unethical because of the power?
Yeah, for sure. And you got to realize like unethical persuasion is super powerful. We'll do another session, you know, and I'll go through some of this if you're curious.
You're going to be on my podcast soon as well. We're going to bring real talk. So maybe we continue the conversation over there for sure.
You know, one of the other things that's on the unethical persuasion playbook is the overuse of super media, highly produced, incredibly distributed, already credible platform media. Fox News is a great example of this. There's no reason for Fox News to be with CBS, ABC, and NBC. Like those were the three, you know, news sources forever. Fox is owned not by an American. It's a foreign entity owned by a guy from Australia. You know, it came in much later than those other three after they'd already established this massive credibility for nightly news. And it's just lived inside that space that it didn't carve out.
Right.
And that's unethical.
So the question becomes, okay, but they didn't just pop on the scene for no good reason. Rupert Murdoch obviously knew he could make a shitload of money.
He bought his way in. Reagan made him an American. He gave him he gave him citizenship and let him. Okay. He wouldn't have been able to own a media entity.
But that's neither here nor there to my point. So let me finish this point. So it's interesting. Thank you for educating me. Like they came along, and the reason they came along was there was a perception by a lot of Americans that those big three, ABC, CBS, NBC, were getting a little more on the opinion side of news rather than doing the news. Now, I know Fox News went the whole other direction and did opinion in the other direction. And what was interesting about this election cycle, Fox even got turned on by people that had supported them.
And that's what's going to happen. Fox, like there's more people coming into the space. So Fox is too conservative. They're now a target and there'll be people come in and, you know, split them open, but it's all going to get fragmented now. But Fox has been this monolith kind of Death Star in the middle of normal American media.
But see, what I'm saying is the reason that came along was there was some kind of absence of some portion of America needing an itch scratched in their head when they see things. So I think that's what kind of precipitated Fox coming on. Well, now look at what's happened. OAN, Newsmax, The Blaze, you got all these like alt-right kind of conservative ones trying to offer even more of an option. And the reason these things pop up is because there is a void of some sort. And now maybe you hear Trump talking about, hang on. Now you hear Trump talking about, when I'm out of office, just stay tuned. We're going to have our own Trump news network. So that's going to now become a juggernaut, at least online somewhere, if you can get some company to give them a server.
Yeah. It, again, like, there's so many issues that creep in here, and parsing them out, keeping them clean enough where we can do, like I said, you know, logical rhetoric on them, where you can hear a claim, find evidence, decide if it's true, and move on, is very difficult. And so, again, one of my just divining rods to start with to try to get people to understand about rhetoric is just have those two camps in your head of ethical only rhetoric versus unethical rhetoric. And they also get dicey. It's sometimes hard to decide who belongs where, and everything gets dragged back and forth between those areas. But if you at least have those as a starting point, then people have some ability to parse things out and then go, okay, am I getting ethical, you know, information here from the, or ethical talk? And am I getting unethical talk? And it's just a really good place to start. And so when you ask me, are you ethical or unethical as a persuader? I would say that you're very ethical as a persuader and communicator. You try to give information. You try to make your points transparent. You're open to different perspectives, all those things that make ethical persuasion. I would say you practice very well. I would probably, if we got into it at some point, question some of your conclusions, where you're at, you know,
sure.
Which, again, that's part of the process. That's what you're supposed to do.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. I'm willing and open-minded on everything I believe. Like, I literally think these people who are so hard-nosed that it's, this is life and there's no around it. And I'll tell you what's really shook that up for me is like life circumstances for me over the past couple of years. I went through some pretty traumatic things. I went away for 6 months after working 15 years in a row. I went away 6 months, finally took a break, Dan. And then that time away, I did a lot of introspection. I had That's things great. Come up, some childhood trauma that I had to come to terms with. Relationship stuff kind of went sideways on me. And that shifts you, and that shifts your ability. I would say probably circa 20 years ago, very much an unethical in that category, just because I was so hard-nosed about what I believed and thought. And now I'm a lot more open. Hey, let's have the discussion. I'm much more interested in not necessarily telling you what I know, but trying to learn what I don't know.
Yeah. And that's awesome. That's what I'm saying. Like, if you anchor yourself with things like that, you're okay. You're doing just fine. You will be fine with where you get to, you know. And that's, again, when I, for a long time, I taught this stuff in college and I got tired of teaching it to 18-year-olds who didn't really understand it and didn't need it right then, you know, didn't care about that stuff. And the idea of being able to bring it out to adults who are struggling with all these things in real life situations, making real life decisions about who to vote for, where to work, you know, all these different things that are trying to figure out these, you know, this stuff will, it's really helpful if you understand it. And that's why I studied it. And it's why I like it. So it's been fun to actually, you know, bring it out and see if I can share it with people. And when guys like you come on who've worked in this, you know, these kind of very public ways, it's fascinating to me to see, you know, what you've done. And anything I can do to help, you know, you with that stuff, definitely would jump in there with you. So
you don't last as long as I have in this community without at least showing some ethical kind of persuasion tactics. And as a marketer, I'm never, in fact, one of the strategies I use, this is going to be interesting to you. One of the strategies I use that goes back to that kind of openness and being forthright is I always say, you know what, if I share something and it doesn't quite pass the smell test, go look it up on your own. Don't just buy it at face value. What I say, that's why I hate the word guru, because guru says, oh my gosh, that's the God figure who knows all. Jimmy Moore don't know all. And Jimmy Moore's the first to tell you that, to go do your own research and look up what I say. If something I say is interesting, it piques your interest, then go look it up and don't just trust me. Same with my books. I don't want you to read my book and suddenly go, oh my gosh, this is every answer I ever wanted about keto. No, it's not.
Right.
But start.
Yeah, that's great. And so, yeah, I'm keeping you over in the ethical persuaders, Jimmy. You are there. You're in the camp. All right. So, I appreciate you talking to me. We're up to like an hour and a half because I said we could talk for this stuff forever. Really appreciate it. Go to Jimmy's LLVLC.com, which is his master location. Check out his 437 podcasts that he runs constantly. He even podcasts while he's asleep. It's the snoring podcast from Jimmy, the living the low snoring life more. And yeah, come back and talk again, Jimmy, and I'll be on your podcast pretty soon. And we'll keep going at this stuff.
Dude, I want to pick your brain about a lot of this nonsense with the COVID thing, and kind of the kind of different camps and why people believe the way they do. And yeah, that's going to be fun to have you on Real Talk.
Awesome. Sounds good. Thanks a lot, Jimmy. I'll talk to you soon, buddy.
Bye, guys.